New York University, and I run the
Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at NYU. And I'm proud to say this is my 18th SEJA conference, but it's not the record. I think Peter Thompson, who's in the, you've probably been to more than 18, right? Oh, 19. And the dean, Professor Jim Detchen, has been to 21, I'm certain. Journalism has changed in many ways. Some of them actually for the better in recent years. And one of the most exciting changes is that we are suddenly have access to a tremendous amount of raw information. It's hard to know really how to handle that information. It feels like a fire hose is blasting all the time. And as journalists, our job is to somehow turn that information and give that information some kind of coherence to make it a story. And so we're the guys with a straw, you know, holding it up to the fire hose and trying to sort of pick out a singular stream that we can use as a tool to create value added for our audiences and employment for ourselves and contribute to the public good and an informed democracy. So the difficulty is trying to figure out how to set that straw so it really works, put that straw on the fire hose. And it really takes expert guidance, and we're lucky today to have two people who are going to introduce some amazing tools that are particularly useful to environmental journalists as we do our job. To my left, your right, is Amanda Hickman. Hi, Amanda. Who is the recently departed program director at Document Cloud, and she's going to talk about Document Cloud today. She is now working at Columbia University's project, the New York World, and she has a very interesting history that is kind of an interesting illustration of how smart journalists or people who are interested in journalism are increasingly embracing data. And she's worked as a community building manager on several sites, and she has a very sort of a data-rich background. To my right, your left, is Charlotte Bick. And Charlotte is the Google Content Manager for the Sylvia Earle Alliance, and I'm sure several of you have heard Sylvia at this conference as well as maybe past conferences and know what a dynamic dynamic carrier of information Sylvia is, both as a scientist and as a communicator. And Google Ocean, the Explore the Ocean layer of Google Earth, is really sort of an extension of her whole persona, I think, in an interesting way. And Charlotte is the person who really makes that happen. She started with the Earle Foundation in 2008, and there she works with hundreds of partners and individual contributors, helping them develop compelling stories about marine life, whether it's oceanography or whether it's cultural human interaction with the ocean or biodiversity. Well, that's marine life. Marine protected areas. She has a very broad portfolio. She also wanted me to let you know that she grew up in Texas and still lives in Texas and went to UT, and so her friends know her as the prairie chicken of the sea. So what we'll do today is begin with presentations, and the presentations will be slightly longer than usual, but we're going to ask Amanda and Charlotte to spend maybe 15, 20 minutes max really introducing you to these amazing tools with a special emphasis on how we can make them work for environmental journalists. And as Amanda is talking, I'm going to start a handout around. Some of them are conveniently stapled. Some of them are not. The ones that are not stapled, just remember there are two pages, okay? So you'll see, take the first page, and then immediately afterwards is the second page. It goes 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. So I'm going to start this around, and we really owe Beth Park, there she is, the heart and soul of this organization for 22 years, for both organizing this panel and putting this amazing handout together. So thank you, Beth. All right. Yeah.
source documents and share more of their source material and their reporting with their readers. This is how it works. You upload a document to Document Cloud, and we run it through a whole series of sort of parsers and slicers and dicers and give you back the text of the document if it didn't already have text information in it, a nice viewer that you can embed on your website, and a whole set of tools that let you search, analyze, and annotate the document. We also give you a ton of tools to organize documents. So you start uploading documents, and you can organize them into projects. You can redact documents. So if you've got a document that's got somebody's social security number on every page of the footer or other personally identifiable private information, you can pull that out, and so you don't have to let that stand in the way of sharing source material with your readers. You can reorder the pages, you can take pages out, you can put pages back in, you can do a lot of stuff to sort of clean up a scanned set of documents, whether that's a federal report that was released on a federal website or something that you had to FOIA and scan yourself. We give you a ton of tools to work through those documents. We also give each document a unique URL, which means that even while a document is inside of Document Cloud and private, documents stay private until you make them public, so it's very much a reporting tool. You can be using, this is sort of a silly little slide, but this is my favorite example. Tracy McMillan is working on a book about the food industry in America and has this incredibly complicated spreadsheet that she's sharing with her editors and her fact checkers and her research assistants. And she's got she's got links. You can't actually tell that there are links here, but she's got links to each document throughout her fact-checking and reporting spreadsheet so that she can hop back and forth to the exact point in a document where she thinks that her fact-checker is going to find the particular item, and then they can highlight it and point straight to that point. So you can really use it to organize behind-the-scenes work on really big reporting projects. You can also use Document Cloud to collaborate. You can share a set of documents with anybody else with a Document Cloud account, whether or not they're part of your newsroom. And I got Dan's warning about freelancers, so I can sort of, Document Cloud is built around a sort of newsroom principle, and we've been working a lot with freelancers to figure out how to sort of extend that principle to freelancers. But one of the things it means is that if you're doing a freelance project with a newsroom that has a Document Cloud account, you can be sharing that set of reporting documents with editors and collaborators inside of a newsroom, because you can share things across accounts just by knowing the email address of the other account that you need to share a document with. And we also... I did something sneaky. I can't share documents that I don't own. We also added a tool that lets you share individual documents with an outside expert. So if you've got someone who you want to look over a document that you've gotten, a FOIA or court filing or whatever it is, you just put their email address in. They'll get a little email. And it's very fussy about names. They'll get a little email that asking them, I don't want to show you that you actually do get to kind of edit that email, but they'll get an email with a link they can use to open the document and start making annotations in it. So you can add a little sort of, this is the document I talked to you about. So that when you've got a set of documents and you want somebody outside of your newsroom to look them over, in whatever context, you can do that. And so use Document Cloud as a tool to collaborate on those documents that you're bringing into your newsroom. And we just got a new Night News Challenge grant this year that's going to let us build out a whole new set of tools to facilitate collaboration with your readers. And if that's something you're interested in, you should come talk to me. That's very much, and we've just begun working on that. Document Cloud, our sort of killer feature, the thing that Document Cloud does that's really fantastic and essential is we let you annotate documents. So if you've uploaded a document and it's in Document Cloud, you just click on Add a Public Note, and just draw a little box around. You probably want to put more interesting context than my sort of lorem ipsum. Not only do you then get a very discrete annotation on the page, which will be available to your readers when you publish it, you also get an annotation which then has a unique URL. And so if you click on that little chain, you can see that our URL has changed. And if somebody loads this document, whether it's embedded on your page or you've just linked them to the document in Document Cloud, they can come straight to that note. That's not that interesting in a 3-page document. If you've got a 400-page document and you want to say, here's where we saw the particular thing that we need you to look at that prompted all this reporting, you can point straight to that annotation. And so, for instance, if you were doing some reporting on I'm going to take a step back. So you can then embed these documents on your own site. It's a very simple, just little embed this document dialogue that you'll walk through. This particular document is not yet public, so it won't be visible if I embed it. So it lets me know that I need to make it public. And then you can nest these documents right inside your reporting. This is some of Ken Ward's reporting on the Upper Big Branch mine. And he's got, you know, this isn't super readable down in this little size, but we can open it out. If he'd added more context in that annotation, we'd be able to read it very clearly. And if we click down here, we can actually open the entire document. And so you're inviting your readers to fact check you. You're showing them exactly what you were looking at as you were going, and you're letting them sort of in on the story. That this isn't sort of an amorphous email. This is exactly what it said. This is exactly how we know that Senator Byrd's staff was asking for rescue team information. And so it's making the story more engaging. It's adding some visual elements to the story, but it's also inviting your readers to challenge you and interpret your findings, which can lead to some really interesting conversations about the work you're reporting on. You can also embed just the note on a page. And this, I couldn't find a good environmental reporting example, but the Center for Public Integrity has been following a lawsuit around payday lending establishments, and they... One official in a particular payday lending business was found making contradictory statements in affidavits submitted to the court. He said his signature was forged in some of those statements and that he never made those statements. And so you could take a picture of that and zoom it in, but embed it. But what they did at the Center for Public Integrity is they actually just embedded that annotation, which they got by coming here and saying, embed a note. This document only has one note, and they just got this little bit of script that they plugged into their page, and they then have those annotations lined up, and you can see for yourself that that final signature, this James Fontano down here, does not look remotely like the verified James Fontano signature, but does look suspiciously like Scott Tucker's signature. And so picture is worth a thousand words, right? So, but, and then if you click on all these documents, and you can see the URL down here, if you click on any of these documents, it'll open the document straight to the annotation. So if you also want to read that whole affidavit, it's there, and it's there for you to read. You can also make private annotations on documents. Public annotations are as public as the document. So when you've got a document that you're keeping private while you're doing your reporting, the public annotations aren't public. Once you publish it, they become public. Private annotations stay private, and you can actually make a private annotation on any document that's public in Document Cloud. So you can make your own notes, organize other people's documents into projects, and come back to them and sort of refer over to their reporting. And you can't reprint a document just because we haven't sort of built tools for that, but these are all FOIA'd and public documents. So you can build off of other people's reporting and refer back to it. So you can be making those private annotations. I'm going to sort of zoom through some of these. You don't have to embed a document in a teeny tiny little box. You can also use a more full screen embed, which is what NPR has been doing in their fracking coverage, as they look over what the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation is learning from Pennsylvania's experience with fracking. And as I said, you can link straight to a document. So ProPublica has done a lot of reporting on both the BP oil spill and the fracking question nationwide. And throughout their reporting on the spill, when they refer to documents, and they've sort of quoted the document here, but they also link another part of the document. Where is that other part of the document? Here we are, right on page 40 of page 248. In ProPublica's website, they get all the traffic on it. They see all the data about who's looking at that. They've bounced you straight to the point in their document, in this 248-page document that they're reading, where they found BP to be downplaying the risks of a spill. They've done some reporting on chemical exposure, and instead of just saying, here, download this PDF that BP provided to us of incident reports and injuries from the spill cleanup, we're going to show you the whole report, and if we think there's something noteworthy in it, we can actually just highlight it and show you exactly what we're looking at. Some of the other really nice things that Document Cloud will let you do with your documents, you can search them. You can search within a single set. You can search the entire corpus of public documents. You can search all of your documents, or you can open a single document and let's see if the wireless wants to cooperate with us today. He's not going to appear in here. Search for specific terms inside of a document, and so when you've got that stack of documents, people often ask us what our competition is, and what we usually say is that it's highlighters and post-its, which you can't search. We also do a nice little, when you upload a document, we pull out all of the date information in it, and we'll give you a timeline of all the dates that appear in a document, and you can hop straight to the mention of that date. So if you're doing some research on a set of documents and trying to find something that you'd have to dig through for, this can be an incredibly powerful tool. Especially if you're sort of like, I know that one of these made a reference to some much older reports and I can't find it. You can pull it up on the timeline and you can see exactly which document, and you can go straight to that mention of a particular date. And we also, a last little bit, we also run all the documents through OpenCalais and give you back, I was saving that for last because I wasn't sure if we'd restored it. We do run the documents through OpenCalais and have been playing with sort of entity searches. And I think a lot of people who've heard about Document Cloud have heard about the entity searches, but they're temporarily disabled. The last little bit documents become part of our public catalog when you publish them. The public can search them, and we always direct searches to your website if you've embedded a document somewhere. So somebody who wants to look for instance, documents about the oil spill, probably doesn't want to put a big, oh, here we go, can find anything that any newsroom that's using Document Cloud has published about a spill and the particular mentions in those documents, and they can see that this is from ProPublica. We've got one from the New York Times, some from the Los Angeles Times. So you can find, so it's increasing in value as a research tool as time goes on. We've now got 3 million pages of documents. And that's after having been out of our beta for a year and a half. So it's a research tool as well for the public to find information about issues they're looking for, find documents, and to find your reporting by extension, because we're always pointing them when you tell us where your reporting is, we point them from the reporting from the documents they found to your reporting on that. That's Document Cloud. And if people have quick questions while we switch over the computers.
I think that would be a great idea. I was just going to suggest the same thing.
Yeah, we could maybe do one or two quick questions. We'll have plenty of time now.
As far as searchability, I know that a lot of the documents are just like pictures, bitmap pictures. And is there any optical character?
Yeah, one of the things we do when you upload a document to Document Cloud is we run it through OCR software. So we do the optical character recognition. We're using a tool called Tesseract. We don't have very high-end tools, so if you have access to better OCR, it'll probably be better than ours. But it is actually pretty good. And I encourage you to sort of look through some of the documents and see what kind of OCR we are able to get. So if the document doesn't have text information, which something that comes in a box on your doorstep often doesn't, we will give you that text information exactly so that we can make it searchable.
And we're not, there may be some flaws in the character.
What's that?
Well, not all OCR translations are perfect.
Right, not all OCR translations are perfect. We actually do give you tools to edit the OCR as well. So if you want to go in and clean up manually some OCR, that's an option. And I think we're all set.
Great. Well, we'll be sure to leave time for questions for both Document Cloud and Google Ocean after. So here's Charlotte Vick to tell us about the Living Oceans layer on Google Earth.
Yes, hi. I'm very nice to be here. I'm very happy to see some of our Google Ocean contributors in the audience. And so let's talk a little bit about how this is done. How many of you have actually been in the ocean in Google Earth? Now, okay, and how many of those people have managed to dive under the water? Okay, so the very first thing that we want to do is show you how that's done. Let's fly to Hawaii because I know it has some really nice bathymetry in it. I'll teach you a couple of little tricks that make it very easy to do. Let's look. You can already start to see a few of our stories that we have in the Explore the Ocean layer. You will notice as we get closer, you'll see more of them popping up because that's the software allowing more and more stories to come to the surface. We're going to get down, and there we go. Here are a few. So let's go in here in the water somewhere near this area. And you see we have a little artificial surface of the water. I don't know if you can see it on the screen up there, but it's kind of a little digital shimmer. And as you get closer to it, you can see it a little bit better. It will even start to move a little bit so you can actually feel it. All you do is hold down your shift key and use the down arrow, and voila, we're under the water. We can cruise around. I don't have the highest resolution turned on here because of the bandwidth that I think we've got. But we cruise around, we come underwater, and we finally find stories. Let's pass that one up. Let's look at this one over here. There are a couple there. So this is the This is some footage from the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory, and they put in just a little snippet of what it looks like from a jet vent, how the water is boiling coming out of the hot vents. And it's taking a little while on the bandwidth to come up, so we may not get to look at that. But you'll notice that there are also credits for who has put the story in, Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory, and then links for more information about that topic. Part of what I want to do today is teach you how to use a few of these things to inform some of your stories. I also want to show you how you can, or at least make some suggestions of how you can embed some of the Google Earth things within your stories, especially if you have interactive online. And finally, also tell you how you could actually take some of the existing stories. You're professional journalists. You know how to tell a story. I'm sure you've done some incredible work that could be embedded in the Explore the Ocean layer and have a second life that leads back to Document Cloud, where you may have some of your stories in their entirety, or you know, where there are papers or things that you would help inform that story. So there are lots of ways to do this, and I don't think we're going to get to see any video. But I have another way we can look at that. Anyway, so that's it. It's very simple. Just hold down your shift key, and the main thing is to wait until you can see the surface of the water before you start diving in, okay? Because otherwise, you know, you might get lost somewhere in space, and that wouldn't be useful. We do know that we are doing extremely well with this layer. It is one of the top layers visited. It's partly because these are embedded in the software in default. Our stories don't cover up anything on land. Most people are looking at the land. First time I heard that we could go and see Google Earth for free, I knew it. You know, you used to have to buy it. So in 2006, somebody said, "Oh, Google Earth is free now," and I went, "Oh, okay, great." I flew to Bora Bora. Everybody goes and looks at their house, not me. I wanted to figure out how the island of Bora Bora was configured because I was working on a project there for a seawater pipe, and I was just like, I don't get it. You fly in and you have to take a boat to go to your hotel. Yeah, and so it turned out that the airport is on the atoll's outer area, and the only thing you can do to get to where there's a hotel is to take a boat. So it's water taxis everywhere. So it was really fun to see that. It was a high island with an atoll around it, which is a very unusual thing. So I want to also show you the easy way. You can cruise around in the ocean in Google Earth and just wander through and look at lots of stories. But there's an easier way for journalists where you need to save time. If you go to the Sylvia Earle Alliance website, which I failed to give for the handout, but it's pretty easy, Sylvia Earle Alliance. And we have a Google Earth tab here. If you open this tab, it will take you to a page where you can search all of the stories that we currently have. As of today, we have 2,075 stories that are currently there. I was recently in London working with some, I don't know why my tab's not working now. Our bandwidth is really going down. Or maybe they've kicked me off. No, it's not. It's that they keep kicking me off of the internet. Let's try this. Yeah, I'm afraid that's going to happen. So, okay, there it is now. Let's see if it's taking it. That's why we weren't able to see anything before. Yes, 6-6. All right.
Thanks for bearing with us. The bandwidth is a big issue, as we all know.
Okay, so let's go to this Google Earth tab, and we get to another version of the same thing you've looked at, but now it's searchable. And the searchability tool is something that we're working to provide to all our partners. The Smithsonian is our largest contributor for this site. We try to go with people who have a certain amount of authority or passion about what they're doing with and in the ocean. But let's say we wanted to find a story about whales. So if you search on whale, you'll get a different set of things because it's singular, or you can get this. So we have stories and stories and stories about whales. You could. I was recently in London and working with some animal welfare people, and they don't understand the issues related to the ocean very well. And they had tried to do a whole series of things, and they had pollution, they had various things, and I said, well, what about ocean acidification? And they said, what's ocean acidification? So I said, well, here's a way you can get up to speed. You just type in acidification, and here we have a whole series of stories by lots of different contributors on that topic, various places around the world. So if you're trying to understand what that is, or if you want to know stories about that that you could use as background and reference for it, you can go to one of the stories. I'll just pick any one here. This one is, let's see who did this one. Okay, this was from Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, National Geographic, several groups, and it's talking about the little pteropods that are the potato chips of the sea. And it has lots of links for more information. You now have a list of places that you can find out people who are involved in this issue. You could go up to a different one. And here's another. This one is also from the same group. Okay. But yes, the Canadian Broadcasting Group has done a great deal on this. Mysteries of the Deep, this is a different one. This is from a research group. And you will... So you could do a lot of work on this, and these are all Aussies, so you can get in touch with all of these people if you thought that the story you were trying to do, you can just follow the lead to where it tells you who they are and how to get in touch with them. So there we go. That is a way that you can do some research. You can also, I've given you on the handout, a tour that Sylvia did of some of her favorite stories when we first launched this. We launched with about 750 stories. There are now, as I said, over 2,000, and it's growing. This year we're going to be moving into Spanish, French, and also Portuguese because we wanted to try to get all of Central and South America added in. That's a new aspect of this. We're trying to scale by adding new communities into it. In addition to that, we're also beginning to scale and move out from our original focus areas that we first tried to just set out. The 750 stories we originally did were discrete areas around the world that were just a sample of what we were trying to do. So we're now starting to build it as it goes forward. You can create tours in the Explore the Ocean layer. And let's get back to Google Earth. So I will show you just a few things that I have often used to make a point about what you can do with Google Earth. If you were doing if you wanted to do something on population dynamics, for example, and you wanted to, demonstrate what's going on in the world in terms of population growth rate, I'm going to pull back so you can see the full globe. And the KML Factbook contains this population dynamics graphic. So you instantly can turn your globe into a population dynamic thing. And you come along, and you might be doing this just to say, I want to do something on population, and here you go. Well, here is a very big spike in terms of growth rate, and it's the Maldives. So the average person would say, wow, why would there be a 5.566% increase or growth rate in population in a little tiny place like the Maldives? I mean, this is what you want to do with data, is you want to look for the anomalies. And you can then go back to it and look around, and then you can find the low growth rate places like Japan. And it gives you the rank. So this would be a very nice graphic if you did a story about population rise and how that has an impact on the environment, and how this would be a very nice link to put in your story to make the point of what's going on and where and why. You can get into the whys yourself. But this is one that would be intriguing to answer, as a matter of fact. That's just one application with a KML file. I'm going to turn that one off. And I will show you other things you can do. You can do a whole series of things, create tours. I have lots of them in here. But I just will turn on one that I just was using the last few days, a couple of them, actually. Okay, so we went out to a few organizations and asked them, in the high seas areas of the world, what do you think is important from a variety of points of view? Is it because of migration of species? Is it because of ecologically and biologically significant areas? What would it be? Would you let us know what those are? So we got responses back, and you can now sort of cruise around the world seeing where various groups and organizations of scientists and things think that there are areas of very great significance. So one of the things that I was trying to do with it is to determine those places where there's some amount of agreement. So here is one of those areas. And I will just zoom in. So this is the Syed-Amalha Banks in the Indian Ocean. And there are various groups that consider that to be a very important place. It also happens to be one of the places that Sylvia Earle has called out as one of her hope spots, but she called it something different. She called it the Outer Seychelles, and rather than the actual sort of geographic area, because she was looking more for a public audience. But so that's another thing that you could do. You could create a whole series of reference points, just plot them onto your map using fusion tables, or you could just go around and individually pick the locations. And that could be embedded in a story about the environment. Another is shapefiles. And the most recent one I have has just come in. And this has to do with places in the ocean. And as it happens, this, again, is considered a very important place for migrating cetaceans. Whales, dolphins, that sort of thing. So this is a way to greatly inform with the geographic references that you have available. The last thing I wanted to show you is just a little piece that I happen to think is really fun. Let's do... To show you the range, I have a lot of things in here that are from scientists. But I also have things in here from conservation organizations, and they do not always have to be boring. So I want to just show you this particular one because it makes a point, and it's also very short, and we don't have a lot of time, but I do want to show you how richly this can be, how rich this can be.
Serengeti of the seas, and it's special because as Australians,
hi Barry,
g'day, only we can protect it. Visit the website and ask our PM to make our coral sea the world's largest marine park. Can you make a difference? You bet your rats.
So what's lovely about it, and you can blow these to full screen. I'll replay it just because it is so short and it's so much fun.
G'day, Barry Rass here. Our coral sea is unique. It's our Amazon, the Serengeti of the seas. And it's special because as Australians...
Hi, Barry.
G'day. Only we can protect it. Visit the website and ask our PM to make our coral sea the world's largest marine park. Can you make a difference? You bet your rats.
So this particular piece is really fun, and it's... they are actually moving along in Australia toward actually protecting the coral sea. It's really more a discussion about how large should it be, and should we add this 250,000 kilometers, square kilometers or not. But I think it's looking very promising, and this has been very effective in getting people engaged in it. It's been very surprising. So people ask me all the time, what are the right stories to put in? The stories that I say that you should have in The Ocean and Google Earth are those things that you personally find compelling. If you have a story that you feel is compelling, you're going to be able to tell it in a compelling way as a rule. That doesn't always apply to scientists, but they need usually a little bit of help in pulling their stories together because they get too involved in the data and can't quite step back from it and understand what would be interesting and compelling about it themselves. So that's where curators and content editors and journalists and people like you come in. You can sort of interpret that for people. So I would encourage you to consider doing this. The interface that we've built for this is so simple that, as Sylvia says, even a scientist can do it. So, but I would be happy to show that to you, but I don't want to take up too much time because I know the Q&A is probably going to be the most important.
Okay, so that was really fascinating, and the two very different tools, but also some interesting commonalities, both about the sort of interactive relationship between journalists and data. Sometimes we're about displaying our work and finding new audiences, and sometimes we're about drawing. Finding the raw data and figuring out ways to make it work to tell our stories. So I'll take the privilege of the first question and just ask a very simple one, just a logistics question for both people, and that is, if someone is interested in either displaying their work or using the data, how can they? What do they need to do to actually make that happen? And in Amanda's case, you had alluded to the issue with freelancers, which I know is somewhat still under discussion, but what would the process be? And then Charlotte, too, if you could talk about if somebody wants to show their work on Google Earth or they have a specific idea of data they want to try to pull from Google Earth and they need help, how can they go about doing that? So, Amanda, you want to start?
Document Cloud is free of charge, and if you go to our homepage, there's a link that says join, and you can just follow that link, and we do have instructions. If you're inside a newsroom, what we need is a note from your editor confirming that they understand that when you make documents public in Document Cloud, they become part of our public archive, and giving us permission to use your name in our materials. So it's not free. We have to be able to say you're using it. And if you're not inside a traditional newsroom, you should. We have some more instructions there, but you should just let us know that you're interested in using it, and we'll work with you to figure out what your sort of ersatz newsroom is, so that we can get you in. We don't have. It's more of a logistical question of sort of what will be your newsroom and what's the best context to add you in. But we're absolutely open to freelancers and have lots and lots of freelancers in Document Cloud.
And in order to find, they should just go to the site.
Yeah, it's documentcloud.org. The join button is really big if you're not logged in.
Okay, if you don't know how to use the Google tools, it is really pretty simple. There's a tutorial for virtually anything and everything you could possibly want to do in Google Earth. The way you find it is just type into a Google search box, tutorial, how to, whatever it is that you're wanting to try to learn how to do. Just how do I da-da in Google Earth. Just, I haven't had it fail anybody yet, so that's probably your best bet. And for really technical questions with respect to anything in Google Earth, there is a place, if you go to the Latlong blog, which is the Google Earth blog, and there is a place there that you can ask a question and someone at Google will answer it. You will never probably talk to anybody on the phone at Google because they all have phones on their desks and they never ring, and that's not how they communicate with anybody or anyone. So it's extremely rare that you would do that. But you will get a detailed piece of information back from someone if it's really technical, or they'll give you a link to the answer. If you can't find it otherwise. So if you are interested in taking the opportunity to put some of your own stories that you've done with respect to the ocean, and keep in mind that the ocean in Google Earth is actually the watershed, the water cycle, and not just the ocean. So we are rapidly also scaling out, dealing with the water keepers, the river keepers, the anything that happens in the watershed anywhere in the world. We're working with some people now in the Amazon with the Spanish language version to begin to do the stories that have that connect the water cycle and everything that is involved in that. So don't feel that I would argue that in almost any case, any story that you do about the environment is really an ocean story, in my view. Whether it's lack of rain or too much rain or whatever it is, it's still an environmental story. If you would like to do that, you just I have some cards with me, but I'm really easy to find on the Sylvia Earle Alliance website. You know, you can find me. But my email address is charlotte.vick@gmail.com. It's very straightforward, and my name is in the program. So it's just make sure you get the dot in between and Gmail, and you've got me. So, and you send me an email and tell me you would like to get a training set up to learn how to put the stories in. It takes about half an hour, and it's mostly just giving you tips. It's the tool that you upload with is so simple that people just go, oh, my gosh, that is so easy. And I always say, if I can do it at my age, and trust me, you can do it. So initially, just to be sure that the stories that are going to go up are going to go up in good condition, I do curate, and I have a team of people that also help me with that on a volunteer basis to curate these stories when they come in. And we usually look at them for a while, just, you know, maybe the first two or three, to be sure you know what you're doing and that you're doing things with some authority, and that they're valid from a science point of view and things are spelled correctly. That's not something I'm too worried about with respect to journalists. From an editorial point of view, it's that the stories are your stories, so they're coming from your perspective. They need to have facts in them and a base, but it is yours. So Greenpeace comes in with stories, and they have one perspective, and the Smithsonian comes in with stories, National Geographic comes in with stories, surf photographers and people who are in the water a lot and just care about it come in with their own kinds of perspectives. It's the richness of where people are coming from that make this work. Yeah. Yeah, there are six. So ecosystems, let's see, I forgot where I left off. Ocean atmosphere, science and exploration, marine life, marine protected areas, ecosystems. Human connection. How could I miss that one? Okay.
So we'll start with questions. And as always, if we could start with SEJ members, and there should be plenty of time for everyone. Yes. Oh, introduce yourself. So Doug is asking what kinds of media can be used, and the answer is almost any media. And then go ahead, Doug, what else did you want?
You said you can take from this to use in your story, but what are the legal restrictions on it?
Right. Doug is asking, you know, what about fair use, whatever exactly that means, and you know, to what extent is it possible just to draw data? Is it considered a open source and just simple rules of attribution apply, or are there legal considerations in terms of drawing information from the site and incorporating it into stories?
If you are going to broadcast it, you will need to get a broadcast license from Google. It's a very simple thing to do, and you just type in, how do I get a broadcast license? But for using the content that we have in the Explore the Ocean layer, it is already in. It is open. All of the links are on the web. So you would use it as a hyperlink in the same way you would anything else on the web. The Google Earth platform itself is not on the web, but the searchability aspect of it that we have on Sylvia's foundation website is something that you can link to. We're also working to get that searchability available to all of our partners. So I know the Smithsonian wants it immediately. We are trying to build the back end of it just to make it robust enough to support the kind of content that they have. One thing I didn't mention on use by authors and things. A couple of the key authors we work with, Carl Safina being one that I'm sure many of you know about, he's actually creating stories geolocated that follow every chapter in his two most recent books, The Sea in Flames and things like that, and then it becomes kind of an illustrated guide to his book. So just so that that gives you some thought, perhaps.
Thank you. And, of course, that's also a consideration with Document Cloud, so Amanda can speak to that briefly.
So our assumption at Document Cloud is that the documents you should be uploading are source documents. They're not all technically primary sources, but that you're, by uploading them and publishing them to your own website, you're asserting that you have some kind of fair use right to redistribute these documents. And we haven't been challenged on that, but that means that you shouldn't be uploading, we don't invite you to upload your own reporting. We invite you to link to it from the source documents, but not to upload copyrighted material. So once those documents are up, we don't have or assert a policy about reuse of documents. We don't facilitate it, but the same way that if somebody posts a PDF on their website, there's nothing that stops you from downloading it and re-uploading it. You're free to do that on Document Cloud. It would be nice if you would play nicely with your colleagues and say, rather than that you got this from BP, that you got this from the LA Times. But that's up to your internal policy. And as far as the documents you're posting go, they should not be documents that you hold a copyright to. They should be source documents that you're asserting you have the right to share with people in the course of your reporting.
So it's somewhat of the Wild West, but as always with the web, sensible rules of the road should apply. Use at your own risk. Amelia, go ahead.
Okay.
All right, so Amelia has asked two very interesting questions. She's asked, Charlotte, is the Great Lakes part of this bailiwick, the bailiwick of this incredible site? And she's asked Amelia, I'm sorry, Amanda, getting mixed up with my AMs. Amelia has asked Amanda, what about actually uploading databases as opposed to individual documents, which could be incredibly useful for some journalists? So, Charlotte, why don't you start?
Absolutely, the Great Lakes is in there, and we do have some stories already in the Great Lakes. There is bathymetry there as well, under the water. So
how small do you go? Just the Great Lakes, or you got thousands?
We're working on the Colorado Ocean Coalition is working on with a group called Teens for Oceans and some others that are starting to do things in the headwaters of the Rockies. So there you go. It's pretty small. Yeah.
Certainly, there's the ability to go as small as you want. It's one of the beauties of the tool.
Yeah. So Document Cloud has absolutely no concept of rows and columns, and it's a very poor place for databases. And one of the things that I said, I mean, this is one of the questions we get asked more often than any other, and at some point a year and a half ago, I wrote a whole blog post about the fact that this is a question we get asked more than any other. And that prompted Brian Boyer and some folks at the Chicago Tribune to write a new News Challenge grant, which got funded this year, to build out a project called Panda, which does understand rows and columns and will be a great resource for publishing and reviewing and sharing databases, whether you've built them or acquired them. And I definitely encourage you to look it out. It's Panda Like the Bear. And it's Brian Boyer's project. And it's not there yet, but it will be a huge resource.
Great. Okay. Other questions? Oh, okay. Joe?
I'm sorry I didn't identify myself.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Davis.
Did
a lot of work for
SCJ.
No, it was on Davis.
Yeah, Joe Davis is asking, where does the application live? Where does the document live? Whose server? And there are legal implications to that, too. So.
This is an eight-part question. I'm just kidding.
Let's take that one at a time, and then we'll keep going. Yeah.
We had actually originally envisioned Document Cloud as a project that every newsroom would host themselves and things would live on their own servers. We quickly found we quickly found that nobody wanted to host it. So what we've got right now is a tool that is web-based. You access it through a web browser, and you're accessing our servers, which are all on Amazon servers. And that's actually spelled out in our privacy policy if you're genuinely concerned, especially about subpoena kinds of questions. And the other, I think another piece of that question that's really important is this something that we can protect in the event of a subpoena? I don't know how consistent that is in environmental reporting as opposed to sort of like law-oriented work, but and the answer is pretty vehemently no. It's all stored on Amazon servers. It's not encrypted. It's really important to be clear about that. That said, a couple of news organizations, including the Associated Press and the New York Times, were very, very uncomfortable with that arrangement and are running instances of Document Cloud inside of their newsroom. So if you have the sort of technical capacity to be running a tool like that, we're absolutely ready to work with you to get it set up inside of your newsroom so that it all lives on your own servers that you completely control, and so that it continues to speak back. It doesn't have to, but that it continues to speak back to our catalog so that public documents are still findable. But the default arrangement is that it lives on our server. The documents do. You do have an option when you go to embed a document to download all of the files, all of the text and image files in JavaScript, and put them on your own site so that you're never phoning back home to us for documents. We haven't found really anyone taking advantage of that option. It was something that we thought was going to be really important, and people have been really willing to just sort of embed outside code.
When it's easy.
So,
right, Joe, I have to keep repeating for the tape, excuse me for doing that. Points out that reporters often want to go to the original source, both, you know, for credibility and authenticity. And Document Cloud, in a sense, is the original source, but it's also sort of a mediator. It's a way to place the original source. And so Joe is asking, how do you sort of, how should reporters sort of navigate that, mm-hmm. that need to have a beautiful place to display, very convenient, loaded with tools, place to put the doc versus the imperative to show the reader, and here's the original source and the original place?
We institutionally don't encourage you to put the sources up as much as I think we should. That's been my sort of like charge that I've been leading. But when you upload a document to Document Cloud, we ask for a couple of pieces of information. We ask for a title, we ask for a source, and you can decide institutionally what it makes sense for you to provide, whether that's the URL or the government agency or something else. We also ask for a description, which then appears on the document. The source does appear on the document, I think. It wasn't appearing for a while, and we had to sort of correct that, but it should be appearing on the document. So that's part of what you see when you open a document. The other thing that we do that I didn't really dig into is that we actually allow you to add infinite key value pairs. So you can add metadata to a document beyond that sort of this is the title, this is the source. If you want to add dates, if you want to add case numbers, if you want to add specifically agencies or more specific information about the sources that you then want to be able to search by or organize documents by, you can add that and add those sort of organizing metadata as much as you need. So if you want to separate out the date you downloaded it, the agency you downloaded it from, and the actual URL from which you downloaded it, you can add that information in. But by default, what we ask for is just a source.
Okay.
And I agree that it is really important, especially as this grows and ages, for the provenance of those documents to be really clear in Document Cloud. We do put your name on it, too.
Other questions? I know one thing that I would like to know is, Amanda specifically referred to it, and I suspect it's relevant for GoogleOcean, too, and that is this notion of interactivity or collaboration with readers. You know, what's coming next, or maybe is already here, you know, in terms of crowdsourcing or, you know, using feedback from people who use the site or people who use our stories directly. You know, how can these tools sort of enhance that dialogue or maybe steer that dialogue in a way that it's productive and not just, mutual and name calling? Anybody want to start with that? Hopefully not mutual name calling, but they'll probably be calling us names. Go ahead, Amanda.
Okay, so we Document Cloud has a new grant that we've just started working on to build out some reader annotation tools, and we're still very much figuring out what exactly that's gonna look like. I think the things we know is that we want it to be something that really integrates with a news site's existing commenting system. And we're sort of starting to figure out what kind of moderation and stuff makes sense. And we're actually actively looking for some partners in that. We're hoping to identify 6 or 7 newsrooms. We've got, I think, 400 that are using Document Cloud right now, and we want a very small number that we can work with really closely to develop this new set of tools that ideally will let anybody or some set of people come into a public document and draw their own annotation on it and add their own context. And so we're looking for some newsrooms that want to play with that kind of collaborative storytelling and reader collaboration to help us figure out how exactly that should work.
And would that take place on Document Cloud, or would it take place on the original site?
It would take place on the site that's hosting the on the reporting site, so on the news organization's website.
On feedback on Google Earth, there are places that you can go on the web and send feedback for Google Earth in general. For the Explore the Ocean layer, we've built in feedback within the searchable aspect of it on the web where people can find it. It's hard, since it isn't, it's a software. It's not, Google Earth itself is not a website. It's a software. And so, you know, you have to go back sort of into other places to the company, you know, to talk about what you'd like to see. Google's pretty good about that. If you send things in and say, I have an idea or whatever, they're very good about responding. And then the Explore the Ocean layer. The whole issue of aging of material on the web is a really significant one. And especially when you're dealing with curatorial things like this particular one, and it's got Sylvia's name on it, so, you know, she's pretty well connected in the science community. So when there is a disagreement, for example, between scientists about how to put forward information, what usually happens is someone will send me an email saying, this story has misidentified this species. This is a taxonomic identification, and we now have DNA evidence for that particular species. And so, you know, we'd like to see that correction made. And I always say, okay, I'll be very happy to provide that to, would you like to be in touch directly? Because they can be. Would you like to be in touch directly with the person because their contact information is on the story and you can discuss it? Or if they would rather I do it, then I send an email and I say, someone has raised an issue with respect to this, and, you know, what do you think? I have not yet had anybody get upset. They've all said, oh, great, I'm glad somebody's looking at this. You know, I'll make that correction, I'll make that change, you know, whatever. But I don't ever change anything on anyone's story without their permission, because that just isn't right, you know. So, but generally speaking, it's a pretty fine thing. I really haven't had all of the controversy that I've had really about how things are positioned has been related to sharks. So,
One thing I wanted to sort of add in again about those kinds of conversations with readers and people wanting to send in corrections, some of the stuff we've seen Document Cloud kind of facilitate is some really interesting conversations that happen wholly off the document. But the Memphis Commercial Appeal broke a really interesting story, which you can actually find if you go to Document Cloud. That we have a featured reporting section where we sort of show off some examples. But they broke a really interesting story. For whatever reason, the FBI at some point in the last year released a document which actually identified a previously confidential FBI informant by his full name and connected that full name to the individual's confidential informant code, which had been in a whole lot of documents that had been released. And so they went back and did a ton of reporting and were able to then link Ernest Withers, who was a photographer who sort of famously took some of these very intimate photographs of King with his sleeves rolled up and his advisors preparing speeches and things, and were able to link him to specific pieces of information that had been provided to the FBI. And what they saw in the follow-up to that was that having published all these documents and having published then each of these original documents and pointed exactly to where that confidential informant ID was linked to a particular piece of information, the conversation about that reporting shifted really dramatically, because instead of the sort of ad hominem, like, these reporters always lie, they don't know anything, what people were saying was, you know, no, I looked at this document, and if you look at this, it comes out in a really different light. And there were still debates, but the debates were really, really based in the source documents rather than people's sort of broader opinions about the reporters or various players involved. And so I think it took the conversation kind of up a notch in terms of kind of civic engagement.
Well, it's noon. Before we say goodbye and thank these two amazing people, I just wanted to make one quick observation, and that is that if you're around young people, talented young people in journalism, you know that their two salient characteristics are their optimism and their fearlessness. And the latter quality, fearlessness, is really relevant to what we've been talking about today. I would urge you, no matter how many years you've been in the business, not to be intimidated by these tools. They are incredibly powerful, incredibly engaging, and audiences will follow. So don't be afraid to plunge in and look for new ways to tell stories, because they're amazing. And thank you to our two guides today. They were fantastic. Thank you. And enjoy lunch.